It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaskans harvest many tons of wild meat each year, but it's a long journey from the field to the table, with skill and care required. On today's show, we'll get our hands dirty, talking about how you should field dress moose and caribou, and key tips for keeping your kill in prime condition for butchering and later cooking. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about cooking up a wild harvest, with recipe ideas and advice on making your harvest tasty. It's a great subject for hunters and family members of hunters, and an interesting topic for anyone who's wanted to understand Alaskan lifestyles. Well, for this first half of the show, we're going to be talking about field dressing. That is, when you've killed an animal, whatever kind of animal it might be, when you're hunting, how do you take care of that meat so that you get it home at the top possible quality and efficiency, and that it's good to eat and will feed your family? And for this segment, we have an experienced hunter who also is a hunter educator. Kirk Lingefelt is the statewide hunter education coordinator with Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and he's been on the show before to talk about the outdoor women program that they have, where they actually do classes and teach women to do these skills. And apparently men are born knowing how to do this stuff, so not too many men get involved, but I think that a lot of people could probably use this information. And for those of you who aren't hunters, it's also just a interesting path of where food comes from. So thanks for being with us, Kirk.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, what are the main tasks when you are looking at dealing with an animal, I guess, is it avoiding waste, right? I mean, that's sort of the name of the game.
Yeah, the biggest thing is we want to make sure that, you know, people get out there and they're successful harvesting an animal, that they meet the criteria as far as what the legal requirements are to bring that meat out of the field, and the steps and procedures, and don't miss anything of that, because we don't want to, we don't want wanton waste is the term used for that. We want all the edible parts and pieces to be brought in, because that's what people are doing. They're out in the woods hunting and getting food for their family, so you might as well bring back all the great edible parts and not just, you know, what you might think might be the key parts.
Right. And that's, obviously you are breaking the law if you waste, although I'm assuming, and I think probably most people are hunting partially for the meat, right? They don't want to waste.
No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, here in Alaska, we have a lot of sport hunting folks, but and they're hunting meat just the same for their families. They may have a little bit more value on the trophy portion of it, whether it be a hide or antlers or horns or something like that. But we have a large population that's just strictly subsistence, and you can't make stew out of antlers. So, you know, they're going to, you know, harvest that animal and get all the pieces and parts off it that they can, because they use a lot of it.
Yeah, the rural life is definitely a part of this, and not only rural life in village Alaska, where you have people who are hunting with their native traditions, but also if you drive up in the fall up the Alaska Highway or the Glen Highway, you'll see people out like looking for animals, because it's part of how people feed themselves in Alaska.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This time of year, there's lots of folks out in the woods running around.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess everybody has a different opinion about what the best tasting game animals are. Duck, moose, caribou are all like fantastic. And can really produce delicious food.
Absolutely, yeah. It's good food. It's lower in fat in many cases, lower in cholesterol than processed beef or meat coming out of a shop somewhere. And absolutely. There's and again, like you say, you talk to 10 hunters, you'll probably get 10 different versions of what's the best game meat out there in the field. So
yeah,
but it's all pretty darn good, especially if it's taken care of properly. It's all pretty darn tasty.
Absolutely want to get into that. That's the most important thing. But also, what about the age of the animal? I mean, if you are wanting to get like nice tender meat, are you looking for a younger animal?
Generally speaking, yeah, younger animals will be a little more tender, particularly a moose. Cows may be a little bit more tender than what a bull would be, and depending on the time of the year, what the activity is. If those bulls happen to be in the rut, in prime mating season, they may not be as tasty. They may be a little bit more gamey because of the hormones that are going through that bull at the time of the season, so they may have some internal issues that make them taste a little more gamey as well.
Yeah,
biological things.
What about caribou?
Caribou, they tend definitely late season caribou can definitely be a little more gamier or tangier, whatever you want to call. I've had some great caribou meat. I've also had some questionable caribou meat as well, you know, you get from folks. And you know, you always, you know, here in Alaska, a lot of people will, you know, give friends a, you know, a roast or something, or pass on some steaks or some burger, you know, to help share in the wealth of their harvest. You know, maybe they have some friends that weren't as successful, and that's always a wonderful thing to do. But again, sometimes if that person didn't properly take care of the meat, you know, it's a great offer that they've made it to you, but it may not be that palatable if it wasn't taken care of very well.
Right. Is there a safety issue in terms of people taking care of meat properly in the field, or is it more just a palatability and quality issue?
Well, there's three main factors when you're processing your meat out in the field. You've got your animal down, and, you know, after you've filled out your harvest ticket, I want to make sure everybody makes sure they get that harvest ticket filled out, man, because it's awful easy to see that animal get excited and then get right into the processing portion and forgetting to stamp your tag. So make sure you get that taken care of. But you want to make sure you want to get that cool meat as cool as possible. You want to keep it as clean as possible, and you want to keep it as dry as possible. And, you know, those things all having to do with, you know, whatever environments you have. I wouldn't say it's so much of a safety issue, but you definitely want to make sure you get that meat. Again, get it opened up. You know, if you need to open up the gut cavity to get some of that heat exposed out of the body so it starts cooling down a little bit better, that's always a good thing. So, yeah, it's just, you know, like I say, the big thing is making sure you just keep that meat cool, clean, and dry. Those are the three, what it all boils down to, ultimately.
Yeah, I guess I haven't really heard of people getting sick from meat that wasn't properly taken care of, although I have heard of people bringing meat to the processor and the processor just rejecting it, saying, you know, this is too far gone. It just has to go in the garbage.
Yeah, absolutely. I unfortunately had a bad experience here about 15 years ago where I got a moose and it didn't get flown into Anchorage quickly, or as quickly as it could have been. And by the time it got here, we definitely had some spoilage. And we took it to a local processor. But they told us, they said, nope, sorry, you know, as much as they wanted our business, they said, no, we can't accept this. It doesn't meet their criteria for acceptability, which was fine. And we understood that totally. But when we went home, we were able to process, my buddy and I that got the moose, we processed it, but we did lose a lot of the meat. You know, we ended up cutting, you know, off of most of the quarters, we ended up cutting about an inch down into the meat before we got into the good meat again, because the outside was a little
right.
Rancid at that point. Yeah. So
yuck.
We were able to salvage some, but we only salvaged about half the moose, which is, you know, unfortunate because that's a lot of waste.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was beyond our control at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that could even happen to you as a guy who's a ton of experience and is even an educator. I mean, stuff happens sometimes.
Yeah. And again, it's those factors. You know, I was hunting, you know, not in Anchorage, so I had to, you know, I left and my meat was supposed to come on a plane with me, but it didn't, and it didn't make it the next day, and then it made it late the next day. But by then, it had been sitting in boxes for a couple of days at the location, and yeah, that's not good. You want to get that meat cool, clean, and dry. You want that air to be moving around, and you know, you don't want to have it boxed up in something where it's just sitting in its own juices, I guess,
yeah,
so to speak.
I hear you, at room temperature.
Yeah.
And I want to get into all that stuff about how exactly to do that in the field, and then also how to learn these skills. But we weren't totally done talking about the different kinds of game people are pursuing. What about waterfowl? Is there any differences or different issues in terms of, like, getting your duck home or your goose home and getting that properly taken care of?
Generally not. I don't have a whole lot of experience with waterfowl, but the folks, with the few times I've gone out and folks I go out with, generally speaking, you know, the animals are breasted out as soon as you get home from the hunt, and that's predominantly the portions that are kept off the animal, and meat's definitely fine and good off that. It's, you know, their bodies aren't as large, so they don't have a huge cavity that keeps that body warmer, so once that animal is dead, that body starts to cool more rapidly, quicker than, say, a large animal like a moose that have a large body, large cavity.
Yeah, and I guess the other category would be small game, which I guess is kind of the same deal. It's a small animal, so you don't have these same rotting issues as quickly because you can keep it cool.
Yeah, again, if you're here, keep it cool, clean, and dry as best you can, and, you know, just do your best. And again, they're smaller animals, so they aren't going to contain that heat in that body as much as there, but you definitely want to, you know, don't delay in processing them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Outdoor Explorer. My guest today is Kirk Lingefelt, and we're talking about field dressing and taking care of game on hunting season, and making sure you get as much as possible of that food back to the table and as good and tasty as it can and helpful as it can be. And my name is Charles Wolforth. So let's sort of go through the steps in terms of, I don't know what, if you want to talk about moose, since that's probably the number one animal that people are pursuing. One of the hunter stories you hear all the time is, oh my gosh, we killed this huge moose and then we didn't think about how far we were from the road, right? You know, and so some of that planning before you even take the animal has got to be important.
Absolutely, yeah. There's lots of times where I've talked to folks where they wish they would have pulled out their GPS and seen just exactly how far away they were before they pulled that trigger, because they realize, okay, I'm X amount away. You know, there's only two of us. You know, if somebody does get a moose down, you're talking, you could have at least six trips minimum, you know, to get that meat out to wherever it needs to get to. And, you know, in a back quarter on a moose, you get a good size moose, could be 125, 150 pounds. That's a pretty big pack that may require two trips just in itself, you know. Yeah. And as we were talking earlier, you know, we're all getting older, and it's nicer to have some younger folks that maybe have a little bit stronger of a back to help out with that. So,
well, and you could end up with the food rotting before you get it back if you have gone too far out into the field.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you want to be able to make sure, you know, again, okay, here's where the animal is. Can I get this out and get it done in the amount of time we need to do? What's the weather going to be like here for the next day or so? Yeah, there's all kinds of factors rather than there's just a legal animal. Let's pull the trigger and then deal with it after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know.
So if it's raining really hard, then you've got another set of issues because getting the meat wet is a problem.
Yep. Yeah. And that's where, you know, but if you're set up properly, you've got tarps, things like that, you know, you can, it's not impossible. It's just, you know, it takes a little bit more creativity and a little more ingenuity, but you can get it done and still produce a quality product.
Mm-hmm. So what you mentioned tarps, what are some of the main tools that you would want to make sure to have, especially any that people might not automatically think of? Obviously you'll need a knife.
yeah well, actually a couple knives. It's nice to have a couple there because they do get dulled, particularly on the animals, depending on what you're hunting. You could have two or three knives around. You want to make sure to bring a couple sharpeners, various types of sharpeners, because again, if a blade breaks or something needs to get sharpened up, you can touch it back up there in the field. A good tarp is really nice to be able to lay out, so when you do remove those quarters off that animal or the various parts and pieces of meat, you can rib cage and things, you can lay them out on that tarp so they can start cooling down more rapidly and get them off that body cavity as best as possible, as quickly as possible.
And keeping the meat clean, obviously.
Yeah, so, that'll keep it clean, keep any mud off that, you know, if you're laying it down on the ground somewhere, you can have it, you know, big enough, you can throw the tarp just loosely over top again, so it might keep some moisture away if the rain is coming down. You know, and ultimately, you know, it's going to get a little wet in the field. It's probably going to get a little dirty, but you just really want to do the best you possibly can because, again, you're going through a large expense of getting out there for this hunt. You might as well make sure and try to get the best product you can for what you're doing out there. In addition to tarps and knives, obviously, you know, sharpeners are great to have along, like we talked about, you know, a couple different various styles that may work for you. Then you also want to make sure you've got surgical gloves. You know, flies are coming around, they land on your hands. It's nice to have those on because it keeps your hands clean, keeps the flies off of you, and then any bugs or gnats that may be coming in because of the blood in the area there. And then also, depending on, you know, if you're hunting black bears or brown bears and you're skinning those out, it's nice to have those gloves because there are parasites. If you get a little nick on yourself and you have a dirty knife, you could potentially give yourself some sort of infection that, you know, most likely will not be anything serious, but it potentially could be if, you know, you did it good enough and didn't get it cleaned out.
Mm-hmm.
So gloves are definitely a nice thing to have. You know, as far as, you know, a strong backpack and some that, you know, depending on how you're going to get it out of the field, if you don't have a four-wheeler that you're driving right up to, you're going to need some sort of backpack frame. Lots of people like external frame backpacks because they can tend to carry a little bit heavier loads. But some people like interior frame backpacks where they can carry a load closer to their body and it feels a little bit more compact and tight to them up against there. It's kind of a personal preference there. A good game bags, I can't stress that enough, good quality game bags. And again, depending on the animal, for a moose, you're going to need at least six, possibly eight or more game bags. and get good quality ones. You know, you don't get the kind, you want something that's breathable, and you want something that's going to go ahead and not tear out when you throw a quarter in. Sometimes, you know, you'll see some game bags that are pretty inexpensive and they resemble more of like a cheesecloth type. And those aren't very good. They've got large gaps between the threads on there. Those bags just fall apart really easily, and there's a potential for if there is a little nick in there, that a fly could get in there and actually land on that meat, and then they could lay some eggs in there, and then you'd have maggots over a period of time, and you know that's not going to be good for anybody as well. So,
yeah.
I can't stress that out enough. Good quality game bags, because even though they may cost a little bit more, they're reusable. You can wash them in the washer and dryer, put them in, get them all ready to go, and they'll last for years. I mean, you know, you can do that. Pillowcases seem to work really well. A lot of people like to use pillowcases. Anything that can breathe and let air through it.
In other words, still not plastic, which is
not plastic. Cause, yeah. Absolutely. Keep it. Yeah. Don't put anything in plastic. About the only time I would ever use a plastic bag around a meat in the field is if I had to really cool it down rapidly and I wanted to maybe put it in a stream that's close by. I prefer to put it inside a bag and then set that bag into the river with the top out of the water, so there's no water getting in, but the cold water's surrounding the warm meat, and then that can help cool that meat down a little bit quicker. But then I wouldn't store it inside that bag. I would just put it in there to keep the moisture off it as it was in the water.
Right.
And then maybe in my backpack as I'm taking a quarter back to my camp, so that way my backpack doesn't get all bloody and nasty, particularly if I'm in a bare area. I want to kind of keep myself clean too as well, mm-hmm. and not have a big bunch of blood all over everything.
Right.
But as soon as I get back to the camp, take it out and just have it in that breathable quality game bag. You know, you want to hang that high in a tree. You want to have some ropes. You want to have pulleys. You want to be able to try to put that up pretty high into a tree because, you know, bears can climb. Bears can have a pretty good reach. So you need to get that stuff up high and out if at all possible. And if you don't have that ability to hang it, then you want to go ahead and maybe have it spread out on the ground. Maybe you can get some branches from some lower brush around and build up a little pillow or something off the ground where that meat can have air movement actually underneath it and around on top, and just loosely put a tarp over top of it to allow air movement around the meat but still be covered from the elements and the moisture out there.
Right. But once you've got the meat, you really want to get back to town and to get it to processor, assuming you're not going to do it yourself, as soon as you can, so that you can avoid this spoilage issue we were talking about. How long do you really have? I mean, assuming you've gotten the meat cool in the field.
If it's cool, lots of people let their meat hang for at least a week before mm-hmm. they'll go ahead and field dress it. Right now, again, a few folks that I know that have gotten moose here in the last week or so, they've only had a few days where they did it and then sent it in because they had a couple good cool days of that. And then the jury's out on how long meat should age before it's processed. Generally speaking, you'll see some of the stuff like some of the Rancher's Reserve beef aged 28 days or something like
right.
that. Everything that I've read and go up pretty much after 7 days, the enzymes or the breakdown of the meat being sitting around after about a week or so, they stop, and that meat's going to be about as tender as it's going to get after about a week.
How do you go about doing that aging process?
Literally, if I get it home and, you know, if I had 3 days in the field and I call my processor and they say, hey, we can see on, you know, Tuesday, and I happen to get in on a Sunday night, then I will just go ahead. Usually if I, generally speaking, my garage is pretty cool, I'll hang it in the garage and I turn a fan on it and have just air kind of blowing over it. It's nice and cool in there. If it happens to be a little warmer out, I can actually lay it down and I'll actually lay it just in the game bags, but on the concrete floor of my garage. And then I just flip it in the morning I'll flip it over to the other side so that side stays cold. And the meat, that coolness will go through the meat at least. And again, it's still it's staying clean, it's staying cool, and it's staying dry in there. Sometimes you may not be afforded that, where you might, you know, if you're out in a hunt for 10 days somewhere, you may have to schedule in a meat flyover, a meat pickup halfway through the trip, because if you're in a, you know, if you're doing a boat hunt, you know, down the Yukon, say, or the Noatak River or whatever, you get an animal on the second day and you still got another week, that's another big consideration to think about.
Yeah.
Am I going to be able to take care of this meat for another 8 days in the field before I even get into town? And then how long is it going to take from town? So those are considerations. You know, your second day of your 8-9 day hunt, you're like, yeah, I might want to wait a couple more days to, but then do you take that gamble and maybe not see another animal in a couple days? So it's kind of a delicate thing. But again, you know, if you're going out, flying out, you can talk to your transporter and say, hey, you know, can you guys just do a flyover? And, you know, maybe we can, you know, you guys can look to see if we got some animals down and maybe they can bring that meat into town and get it frozen up for you, or at least put it in a refrigerator storage somewhere.
Mm-hmm. We're talking on Outdoor Explorer today about handling wild game and a bunch of different aspects of it, and got a super expert guest today, Kirk Lingefelt, who is the statewide hunter education coordinator for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. There's obviously a lot to learn in how to field dress an animal, and you have a pretty innovative program with your education program of actually getting a reindeer, which is the exact same animal as a caribou, and showing your students how to do it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, through our BOW program, the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, we've offered field dressing classes in the past year where we've actually gotten reindeer, and we'll divide up a class and maybe put 6 to 8 participants maybe on an animal, and they'll go through the process of actually quartering that animal out, removing all the edible meat off it. We'll actually go through some parts in the anatomy with the students just so they can kind of see how things work and realize, you know, the front, taking a front quarter off is way different than the back quarter, and things to think about when you're in the, taking off that back quarter. You know, you don't want to cut the bladder, you don't want to, you know, cut off, leaving evidence of sex attached. If that's a legal requirement in the area, that's a big thing to make sure to remember. That's one of the leading causes of violations here in the state.
Can you explain that?
Well, if you have a permit for, say, a bull moose, antlers aren't necessarily evidence of sex. You need to keep evidence of sex with either the penis sheath or the vaginal orifice attached to one of the back quarters on there as the proof on there until it gets to the processing location.
Got
and then that can be removed off, because if you get stopped and somebody checks out your animal, that's the legalities of the evidence of sex on there. So that's one of the things you definitely want to make sure. Certain game units, you want to make sure that you also have the legal requirements in some game units. Livers may be required to be taken out, or maybe the kidneys may be required to take out, where in other game units may not be. Other things as well are boned in or boned out meat. Lots of people like to take the meat or take the bones out of the meat when they're transporting it around because it's a lot less weight. And that's a great thing if you're packing that meat out on your back. But there's also considerations to be aware of when you do take that bone out of the meat. Now you have, instead of just a nice outside case of a quarter, if you slice down the center to remove that bone, now you've got all this exposed surface area that was not exposed before on the inside. So now you've got it flailed out. So if you can imagine kind of like opening up that back quarter, now you've got all this exposed skin area or meat area that will close back down on itself when it's in a bag, and it's just kind of a lump of meat at that point in time.
Great opportunity for bacteria.
Exactly, because there's not much air movement around inside there, so you want, that's other things you have to do a little bit more care of that meat. Those are considerations. Again, make sure in the game unit you're in, what you're in. Kind of got a little sidetracked.
We were talking about how you teach the process.
And we will we'll go through and
kind of
and
sounds like kind of like dissecting an animal in ninth grade biology.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And we do a little bit different technique. We actually use a technique where you can get in and field dress the animal without having to get into the abdominal or gut cavity at all, and until the last final phase of the butchering process, and that makes things a lot cleaner and a lot more. Just a lot more better all the way around,
yeah,
I guess.
Less likelihood of contaminating the meat.
Yeah, because you don't have that big gut pile you're trying to roll out of the way and things like that. It's all contained inside there. There should be no stink, no smell. Hopefully you can get those quarters off. But, yeah, we'll start with the students, and we'll just kind of give them the initial rundown. And generally speaking, we'll cut from the back of the head, between the ears, all the way down through the spine, and all the way back down around through the back to the rump and around the anus, and then back down one of the back legs to the lower hock down there. and then feel the skin off from the back rather than from the belly, which most people, you know, traditionally used to open up the gut cavity from the anus all the way up to the top of the ribs and then open that up and remove the gut cavity. And then they would get into the process of removing the skin off the animal and things like that. Huh. We came up with a video back in 1999 when I first started with the department, and we addressed it as field dressing for big game animals because we looked on the market and saw that 99% of the videos out there were, a couple of guys going out shooting a white-tailed deer in Texas or right. Colorado, driving up to it, putting it in their truck and bringing it home and then hanging it in a garage and then going through the process. And that works fine for that, but not so much here in Alaska.
Right.
So we looked at it and made a really great video, and it's about 50 minutes long and goes through the process of, again, how to field dress this whole animal. So that's available on our Fish and Game website. Yeah,
and we'll have a link to that on our website, outdoorexplorer.org, and we'll have links to Kirk's program and also to his video, so you can find that information. And video obviously is big help compared to what you used to have, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice. You can buy copies of it, but you can also look at it straight on our Fish and Game website. And it's just a good reminder to kind of watch on through. Oh, yeah, I'm not really sure about getting around in that back quarter. What's the easiest way to leave that evidence of sex attached? That information is all on here. It's a great video, so all our students get one of those when they come to the class. But again, we just kind of point out to those students saying, okay, here's, because they didn't come to watch me cut, so I don't get a knife in my hands. I just kind of point around and work them through, or if they need to change an angle on a knife, we'll change them.
And it's not rocket science. They can pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And they do, and they'll get in there, and someone will cut for a few minutes and then tap somebody on the shoulder and say, okay, hey, I'd like to get in there now, and that person will work on that. So they kind of see the whole process. They aren't doing the whole animal themselves, but they're doing it as a group, which is what you generally would do anyways in the woods. So they're learning a process, and again, it's a great controlled environment for people to learn in, because, again, it's not trial by fire. It's like, okay, I've got this animal down. Now I'm going to learn what I got to do with it. Well, they can learn before they go out into the woods and feel that much more confident and comfortable.
Yeah. So when you get to the processor, they're going to ask you how you want to have your moose, assuming we're talking about a moose, processed, how much you want as hamburger and how much you want in different cuts. How do you make those decisions?
I let my wife.
Yeah.
it never fails. One year we're like, boy, we didn't have much burger for last year. Let's save more burger this year. And then the next year, we had a lot of burger left over. Uh-huh. We didn't have much steak.
But I mean, if you had a really old and a more elderly moose, you might go for more burger.
More burger, absolutely. Yeah, something like that. My wife had got a muskox a few years ago, and
that's supposed to be delicious.
It's really good. It's very lean, and but it was a bull, and it was an older bull, and so they tend to be a little bit tougher. So we really only kept the really prime cuts of meat, which are like the back straps and tenderloins. And we kept a few roasts and a couple, maybe some sirloin tip steaks and stuff like that. But the rest of it, we pretty much ground up just because it was an older animal. We knew it would be, a little bit more, tougher.
Yeah.
It's never fails. One year you'll have more than another. But though I will say this, one thing that we started doing is we keep more roast. And if we don't end up using those roasts, then those roasts can get cut into steaks if we eventually need them. Or if we decide, hey, well, you can make it into burger,
always
but you can't make a burger back into a roast. Right. So we've learned to kind of, again, keep the prime cuts of the steaks that we look at and then go for the burger. And again, burger, particularly if you've got, kids in your house, burger.
You can use it a million different ways. Yeah.
Spaghetti to chili to,
absolutely.
To hamburgers. To
if everything people don't like moose, you can have it in the chili and they won't even know.
Exactly.
So, and obviously there's lots of companies doing this around town. It's kind of a matter of finding one who has time for you, right? Because in the fall, they get very busy.
Yeah, they're pretty busy right now. Same thing. One of my friends went and looked and went to three different shops on Monday. And
we're pre-recording, so that would be a couple of weeks ago now.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And they weren't able to find anybody, and they actually ended up going to a shop out in the valley out there that had some space available for them. So
there's a lot of people doing this out there. A lot of people getting their winter meat. Well, thanks a lot, Kirk. This has been fascinating. It's so much information, and we'll make sure to get all those links up on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show and you'll find all that. Kirk Lingefelt, statewide hunter education coordinator from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Stay with us on Outdoor Explorer as we continue to talk about wild meat.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is wild food, the food that we harvest as Alaskans, and making sure we get it home safely and healthily, and then what do we do with it once we're cooking it up? And I've got a couple of guests who know a lot about this topic, and we're going to have a fun conversation for the last half of the show. Amy Foote is Executive Chef for Nana Management Services. Thanks for being here, Amy.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And Dana Feluca Lingefelt is a hunter and cook and also the spouse of our guest from the first half, Kirk Lingefelt. Thanks for being here, Dana.
Thank you for having me, Charles.
So this is a big part of your life, right, Dana? I mean, I know that cooking and especially cooking food that you and your husband catch is a big part of your life.
Yes, it is a big part of our life. We typically don't buy any meat or fish from the store. If we don't catch it or kill it, I pretty much do not eat it. And I've gotten so fussy about the quality and purity of my meat that I take my own meat with us on trips that we go to so I can make certain that I'm having good quality food when we're out of town.
Wow. Wow. So what is your favorite? Let's just start with favorite dishes. Of all the many things you prepare, what's like the thing that you really look forward to?
Well, salmon is my all-time favorite food to eat.
Yeah,
but
me
as
too.
Far as game meat, probably elk is my favorite. I love elk. Venison's probably second, and then closely followed with moose and muskox.
Uh-huh. And you, so let's start with elk then. How would you, I mean, walk me through how you would deal with an elk.
Well, as a cook, I guess if you're going to hunt it yourself, probably the first thing you want to think about before you even get into the field, in addition to, are you going to cape it? How you're going to clean it? You want to think about the cuts of meat that you want.
Right.
And once you have decided on the cuts of meat you want, once you get into the field and you begin your field dressing, I think it's probably a lot easier thinking ahead. That way, then you know how you need to field dress your animal. So when you get it to where you're going to butcher it, it's already ready for the cuts that you want to have.
Uh-huh.
My favorite cut, you know, other than the tenderloins and backstrap, is probably the sirloin tip. I find that to be pretty consistently tender in most animals. And probably my favorite way to cook game is on an open fire or on a grill. And I like to use salt and pepper, a little bit of garlic, and grill it. Most of the meat is so delicious up here, I don't find that you need to put a lot of sauces or a bunch of anything fancy on it.
Just like throwing steaks on the barbie.
Pretty much. Uh-huh. And I love a good chimichurri sauce. I worked for an Argentinian family for a couple of years and learned how to make terrific chimichurri. So probably one of my favorite, most simple meals is a delicious game grilled steak with some good chimichurri sauce on top.
Now, some people like to eat their beef rare. Tell me what, it's not always such a great idea with game, especially if you're talking about bear.
Well, bear, I mean, it's got some bear up here. You've probably read stories that it has a trichinella worm. And if you don't cook it to at least 165 degrees, there's a pretty good chance that you're not killing those worms and that, you know, the human could get trichinosis.
Mm-hmm.
Game meat, I think maybe a good rule of thumb, and Amy, correct me, if you cook anything to about 160, 165, you're probably going to kill it, you know, kill the disease. If you like your steaks rare, however, you're probably going to want to be more like a 145 internal temperature. I personally like mine medium. I don't like it too red, but I cannot stand it well done. So for me, medium is a good doneness for me.
Yeah. Well, I've had caribou completely raw when I was with the Inupiaq people on the North Slope
you know, that freezes immediately. And then you just cut off a piece and eat it. And it tastes like super rare.
Oh, I bet it was delicious.
tell me about, like, what are your favorite, very favorite game meats to prepare and to eat?
So I'm originally from Idaho and spent about 12 years in Montana. And we lived very much how you described my husband and I and my two children off harvesting or growing our own animals. And so when I relocated back up to Alaska, I actually flew 3 coolers full of game meat with me because I wasn't willing to give up my antelope and my elk that I had harvested. And so, you know, very true to my heart as well. Elk, I would say, mostly probably from exposure and upbringing, is an all-time comfort food for us as well. So what I like to do that maybe is a little bit different is a lot of the preparations that I take into consideration, whether it's in my personal life or in my professional life, have to do with kind of the land where the animal is living. And so if there's an opportunity to harvest other things along with that animal specifically, you know, the cranberries or the Labrador tea or juniper berries or things like that you can season the meat with that comes from where they're at or those preparations, then that whole picture kind of comes together for me on the plate. So it's a different approach. And then being a working mother of 2 children, I honestly use the crock pot at home personally all the time. You know, I cook for a living. And so when I get home, a lot of times having children and having those kind of comfort foods. So I've learned to kind of be very efficient at cooking foods for my kids in the crock pot and kid-friendly food and kind of some mainstream things as well, you know, chilies and spaghettis, you know, things with noodles that on that end of things too on the personal front. So I get to play with more exotic flavors and more different, you know, presentations and things like that all day at work. And then when I get home, you know, we can have a bowl of chili or we can things like that. So,
well, and you do end up with a lot of ground beef or not ground beef, but ground meat when you hunt moose and caribou.
I mean, absolutely.
There's a lot of different things you want to be able to do with that.
Absolutely. And I think for people that haven't had wild game, that's a really safe way to kind of step into it. The field dressing, the care of the meat, the cooling of the meat, the food safety is really, really important before you get it. But once you have it in that comfortable form where it's kind of this ground thing that looks very much like a ground cow would for most people and be comfortable, I think, you know, the consideration of the fat content, obviously you can't just kind of patty up just straight meat if it's moose because it's so lean. So, you know, learning different items that you can incorporate into that. Everybody's favorite is bacon.
How do you do that? So if I've got some very lean moose meat and I want to make some burgers on the grill, then I need to get some fat in there so it'll hold together?
Exactly. A lot of folks use bacon. Because everybody loves bacon.
Right.
Bacon does add a lot of seasoning to it as well. You can buy, in fact, my cousin got a moose and lives in Port Ellsworth. I do her grocery shopping. I sent her just some pork butt and so that she could grind it and add it into her meat so that she could use it for padding. Pork fat works great. Beef fat works great.
You can buy suet.
You can.
At some of the stores around. You can even ask for it. That it's come from a cow, if you're getting cow suet, that doesn't have any hormones, antibiotics.
Right.
You know, one of the whole purposes, at least for me, of hunting is to have meat that isn't contaminated by man with all these other things. So I was at our butcher one day, and I had some bison suet left over from my bison. And I told him I wanted that added in. He said, well, why? It's a moose. And I said, well, I don't want beef suet added in because I don't know where that cow came from. I don't know what is remaining in its fat, and I do not want that contaminating my game meat that I just worked so hard to bring in. And I've noticed at Whole Foods, they have suet that you can buy that hasn't been pre-contaminated by man. So if you would rather, you know, buy that at the store, take that to where you're butchering your animal, you at least have an alternative from pork or, you know, another animal that's had antibiotics and so forth added to it.
So let's take on the issue of gaminess. And I In my life as a journalist in Alaska over many years, I think I've eaten just about every kind of animal you can eat and just about every kind of part. And I, fortunately, nothing seems to bother me. And it's great for going to parties because you always have, you can always talk people about weird stuff you've eaten. But for a lot of people, they're kind of scared of eating game because they say, oh, it'll be gamey. It'll have that flavor that's not, it doesn't taste exactly like, you know, corn-fed beef. When you're, and I want to hear from both of you, when you're thinking about cooking, are you thinking about, well, I guess, first of all, where does that come from, that sort of gaminess? And is that something you try to cover up or avoid, or how do you deal with that?
I think arguably just being someone that eats game meat regularly, and then going back to beef is very gamey to
me.
So the term gamey comes from what you're kind of comfortable with and what you're used to eating. A lot of the animals will taste like what they're eating. If you shoot an antelope that's been feeding on sage, it tastes like sage, very much so. A lot of that gaminess has to do, again, with the field and making sure that you're cooling it properly, that you're taking care, I think, of the meat. In my experience, there's a lot of things you can do with it once you get it. If you have had animal that maybe like a moose that's a little bit muddy in flavor, one that's in rut, like you said, that has a lot of hormones in it. So, you know, at home, if I have something like that, then I soak it. Milk is great. Buttermilk's great for getting away with gaminess. If you're out in the field, that salt content of seawater will help pull some of that out. Freezing also tends to kind of pull the blood from the tissue. So once you've froze it and you thaw again, some of those juices that come out will take, unfortunately, in some ways, will take some of that flavor out as well, if that's a flavor that you like.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
I think having a good, clean kill in addition is good, because if you shoot that animal once and it goes down immediately, it's not in a panic, it's not running around, it doesn't have all this fear hormone coursing through its system that may taint the flavor of the meat. So, you know, having one good, clean kill shot, I think, is important, in addition to, unfortunately, hunting season is during the rut most of the time, so you may not be able to avoid that. But just being careful of making sure your animal's nice and still when you're shooting it, maybe not one that you've chased all over the mountain for half the morning, if you can avoid it. And then the other things that Amy said as well.
It seems like you have to evaluate what you've come home with in some level and decide, okay, how am I going to use this, as opposed to going to the grocery store and just picking something out and cooking it. And how do you, I guess that takes some experience, doesn't it, Dana?
I would say yes, and probably what you like to eat as well. When we get a game animal, we will typically, you know, get all the roasts and steaks, all the better cuts off of it, and then whatever is left over, you know, the neck meat, maybe shanks or whatnot, that all is ground into burger.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of know what I'm going to do with my meat ahead of time. So I already have an idea in the field how I'm going to field dress it. I already have specific game bags set aside for each of the items that I know I'm going to have to haul out of the field. I'm kind of a neat freak, so I like everything separated and kind of just so.
Uh-huh.
And then when I do get it to our butcher, we've been going to the same family for several years, and he kind of knows how I like to have my meat cut, how thick I like my steaks, and so forth. So
you got it dialed in.
Yeah, I think we have it down for our family and friends.
That's really a wonderful thing to have a butcher that you have that relationship with. I personally do all my own butchering at home. I have some nightmare stories of over the years of different things that you do get back. And so when we harvest our animals, they come home and I'm the butcher at my house. So
that must be a huge amount of work.
It is.
It can be in Montana. For many years, every year we would harvest, you know, our limit on antelope and deer and elk, and hunting season, you know, and thereafter can be a lot of hours.
Yeah.
You know, when I had my son Birch, he was not quite a year old, and he was in a pack on my back. I was butchering an elk, and my son Tucker wanted to participate. He was three, and I gave him a a chunk of roast and a plastic knife, and he was helping mom butcher, right. You know? So you have to make it a family affair.
Yes.
That sounds like a perfect
picture. Develop
that
love early.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wohlforth, and I've got two guests who are culinary experts in the studio to talk about doing a good job of cooking up your wild game. Amy Foote is executive chef with Nana Management Services, and Dana Feluca Lingefelt is a hunter and cook, and we've heard from her husband, Kirk, in the first half talking about field dressing your wild game. I'd like to talk a little bit about waterfowl and sort of what are the best ways to handle it. And I understand, you know, there's that goose can be kind of a challenging thing to cook. It's got a lot of fat. And so have you guys done much with goose?
So I've done some work with goose. A lot of the goose that I've worked with was harvested by my brother-in-law. But the thing with goose, it's very similar to other animals. You need to process it properly out in the field. Same thing, you need to get it cooled down. And when you're working with any animal that does have some fats, you know, you need to be aware of what you can trim, what you need to keep, what you don't need to keep. Very similar methods of soaking in different milks to tenderize. Buttermilk is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, people do fried chicken with buttermilk. Well, it applies to other birds.
Okay.
and that same approach to harvesting the plants and the plant life that is around with wild game and wild birds goes hand in hand. So using that same juniper or cranberries, you know,
wild blueberries,
duck à l'orange, you know, is not necessarily, you know, what's harvested up
here. How does the flavor of goose compare to duck? I'm not sure I've ever had goose.
It's very similar. More people would call it maybe gamier. It's got a little bit of a stronger, I feel like a stronger flavor to it. A lot of it, honestly, I think is smell oriented. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of your senses go into when you're eating. And so goose to me has a little bit stronger scent to it, just a natural smell to it.
Dana, tell me about how you prepare duck. I'm sure you've done it many times.
I've only done it a few times, and I have mostly grilled duck breasts and then prepared, you know, like Amy's saying, if you have all these natural berries and fruits and things around. So I prepared a wild blueberry sauce to go with the duck breasts a couple of times. One of the best duck recipes I've ever had, my friend Gina made, and it was so simple. It was duck breast and with a little bit of cream cheese, a little bit of jalapeno, and then wrapped in turkey bacon and baked. And they were just little appetizer bites, but there was something about the combination of those four simple flavors. It was probably some of the best duck I'd ever eaten. It was quite delicious.
I think duck breast is maybe one of the best
foods
in the world.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with that. I think it's one of the most overcooked pieces of meat as well, because, you know, with the poultry and you know, food safety, but a medium, you know, medium well duck breast is how you know, really want to have it. And mm-hmm. I use a lot of ginger and soy and birch syrup, you know, when I'm working with duck.
It's already it's got so much to it already.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in rural Alaska, duck soup is super popular, and I've had delicious duck soup. And I've made certainly chicken soup and turkey soup. Ducks, making duck soup kind of the same deal?
I would assume so. I haven't worked a lot with duck in a soup kind of sense. I would imagine that, you know, like any animal, that's what I wanted to say too while we were here, is people forget the bones. Mm-hmm. There's just so much wonderful things about the bones that you don't want to get rid of, and those stocks and those sauces and that richness and the marrow, and the same thing with duck. You know, in that duck soup is keeping those bones in it and getting those flavors. Yeah. So,
do you make much soup, Dana?
I do. I typically make cream soups. I have never made a duck soup before. Probably like an asparagus cream soup would be my favorite.
Okay. What about small game? Like, you know, rabbits and like ptarmigan and stuff like that. Any insights on how to handle that kind of meat?
Well, ptarmigan to me would be just like handling a pheasant or any other small game bird. They're quite delicious. And, you know, there's not a real strong flavor. So I like using a little bit of garlic, just kind of keeping it simple. And I've cooked breasts several times I love using the Dutch oven. So cooking them in the Dutch oven with just little onion, garlic, and potatoes makes up a nice little meal. Quite delicious, and everybody's usually pretty surprised that, you know, something that tasty comes out of these little Dutch ovens.
Yeah, cool. I know we talked about that before, and that's a great way to go. Amy, do you have anything to throw in on that topic?
I would just say that a lot of kind of that slow and low cooking, you know, similar to a Dutch oven, like she was saying, the braising any type of game meat, even, you know, the small game in wines or vinegars or those berries that have all those tannins, that really makes a big difference in carrying those flavors through and making it more tender.
So I think that one of the issues that people come up against is when they shoot a moose or, and I'm not sure if this is true with caribou or not, but with an animal that's maybe older and stringier and maybe like not as, doesn't have the nice tender meat, does that mean that you would grind up a lot of it as burger, or would you, could you use the crock pot to deal with that? Or what are some of the techniques to deal with meat that's simply not the best?
Yeah, I think crock pots, pressure cookers, lots of people are working with pressure cookers. There's all kinds of fancy, neat, modern gadgets you can buy. But I think, you know, going back to the simplicity for me as a chef is some of that. You know, you can get those desired results with just slow and low cooking as well. Convenience, you know, living in town or, you know, having a family or working or things like that, the grinding makes it more versatile for people a lot of times, more comfortable to work with.
Right.
I agree. Yeah. And the one thing with the grinding, if you do want to give it to your friends and family, it seems like a lot of people feel like they know more what to do when they get ground meat as opposed to a steak or something. So, you know, if you can, if you do plan on giving it away or sharing with friends and family, sometimes they are more comfortable receiving ground meat as opposed to a steak or a roast. Yeah. But like Amy said, you know, if you just cook it low and slow, so the heat has time to break all that connective tissue and yucky stuff down, then, you know, it, chances are it's going to turn out to be pretty good.
But my kids seem to like it, meat better from the crock pot than anywhere else.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, you know, like you could have the filet mignon from the grill, but they'll take the crock pot. They just love that stuff. So you guys must have huge freezers, right, to put up all this food and keep it good through the year. Let's talk a little bit about making sure that when you freeze your meat that it's going to continue to be good, how long you can keep it in there, and any tips about just freezing and having good success with it. Dana, do you want to start that one off?
Sure. We have two large freezers. We try to keep one for all of our fish and one for all of our game meat. And the one thing I like about both of our freezers is they freeze super fast. So as soon as you put something in, even if you put in 200 pounds of meat at the same time, it is frozen very quickly. I think that's probably important for the longevity of your game meat.
Yeah.
Also, well, with ours,
and I don't want to interrupt, but with fish, it's almost, I mean, if it freezes too slowly, it'll be ruined.
Yeah, it could be ruined. Yeah. With the meat, we always wrap ours in plastic first, then wrap it with freezer paper. And I've had game meat last up to 5 years.
Wow.
You know, you forget that you may have a pack of ribs back there, or God forbid you find a backstrap back there. You pull it out. I have never had meat with freezer burn on it. I have never had any game meat go bad from being in the freezer,
so
you know, longer than a year, let's say.
Do you vacuum pack it then, or just Ziplocs?
No, just, well, not Ziploc, just regular saran wrap. Wrap it in saran wrap once, and then wrap it with freezer paper, tape it all up, and throw it in the freezer.
Okay. Amy?
And that's similar to what I've done. I've worked with both. I find that vacuum packing, unless you have a fleet of people helping you or a very high dollar unit, it just takes too long. It's more time consuming. You don't really have, you know, you're exhausted by the time, you know, really, let's be real, processing an animal to that extent, it's a lot of work.
Or if you've been dip netting, you're exhausted.
Yeah, you're tired when you get home. And so a lot of the fish that I've worked with, it's the same approach, like you're saying, you know, where you're looking at that. The freezer, I wanted to comment on that. The freezers that we have, I think purchasing a freezer and getting a freezer, if you are looking at holding, the industry has gone to having self-defrosting and little bells and whistles like that. And I have found that that is not good for the end result in keeping game meat, because it does shut off, go through a defrost cycle, and that outer layer of meat can start to thaw and then refreeze and then thaw and refreeze as it goes through that whole process. And so for me, having a consistent deep freeze is really important in the longevity and the quality of your game meat.
So when you're shopping for a freezer, what are you looking for exactly? Or what are sort of the key phrases to look for?
I don't buy anything that self-defrosts.
Okay.
It's because in that realm of things, it is bringing it to a higher temp to allow for that to melt off.
Uh-huh.
And then goes back on. And so the product in there, you know, you could have a good seal on it and work through that. But I historically, in my experience, that tends to decrease the quality of the meat and your longevity with it.
Yeah,
so
great. Yeah, neither of our freezers are self-defrosting.
Yeah. Yeah. So you want a deep freeze, and no, self-defrost is great if you're in and out all the time and you've got, popsicles or frozen vegetables or things like that, and you're turning through your freezer. You're not truly using it to preserve for a year.
And that's what you're thinking. Continue eating your meat until the next hunting season, and hopefully
absolutely.
Next hunting season starts and the freezer is just empty.
Yes.
So how do you go about packaging what you're putting in the freezer, knowing that it's going to be the right amount when you take it out? So Do you think about packaging it so when you take it out, it'll be just meal sized?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And that's based on your family size.
Yes.
That's based on what you like to eat, mm-hmm. what your menu is, generally how you eat. People do eat very consistently. A lot of people do.
Yeah.
Not that they have, tacos every Tuesday, but, knowing what, your recipe size is going to take and being aware of
that. Because you only want to defrost what you're actually going to use at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not a big fan of reheated game meat at all. A lot of people aren't. So being aware and knowing that, your batch of chili takes a pound of chili, or it takes, 2 pounds of burger. You use a pound and a half of fajita meat. It just really depends on your family and your lifestyle. Wouldn't you say that's really...
Yep.
Knowing who you are.
Yes. The butcher that we use, you take the meat to them in your game bags. And while they're cutting the meat, you're actually wrapping your own meat. So you're guaranteed that you're taking home your own meat. And the beauty thing about that is, like Amy's saying, well, we know how many people are in our household. So I will have him cut maybe 6 steaks out of a roast. And when we package those, I will package those 2 at a time, because I know if it's just my husband and I, or if we have company or whatnot, I can either take out this many or I can take out fewer, depending on how many folks we're going to have.
Yeah,
and,
makes sense.
You know, when you're out in the field and you're hoofing and you're carrying that animal in, the last thing you want to do is waste meat.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, really thinking ahead and planning out, at least in your head, your menu and how you're going to use your meat so you don't have any waste is, I think, paramount.
Absolutely. Well, this has been such a good conversation. It went by so quickly for me. You guys are just fascinating. Amy Foote, Executive Chef with Nana Management Services, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dana Faluca-Lingefeld, who's a hunter and cook and knows everything about meat, it seems. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Charles, for having me.
And in the first half, Dana's husband, Kirk, was a great advisor as well. So that's all for today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro, who works out our guests and gets them in here, does a great job. Stay tuned again next week for Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.